Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at pem.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
We were getting so many very graphic, threatening calls and emails that I just felt it was safer to put the flag back up.
The American flag returns to Hampshire College. We'll dig into that story and more in our Week in Review. Plus, our look at Donald Trump's cabinet picks and their impact on Massachusetts. Today, school choice proponent Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education.
So many people get focused on school buildings and the results of buildings, and I encourage them to really look at each individual child.
Also, holiday cookies with famed cookbook author Dori Greenspan.
You know, cookies, they're delicious, they can be seriously delicious, but they're all about fun.
Cookies, 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 we go cookie eating cookies, maybe we should stop.
It's Radio Boston, first the news.
Let's have more.
Told we have to do something.
You're right, I'll get us some milk.
No, we must stop.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and time for the Week in Review.
I say, raise the flag!
Raise the flag! Raise the flag!
Protesters there at Hampshire College over the weekend. The college had originally lowered the Stars and Stripes to half staff after the election, then removed it entirely after someone had burned it. Today, Hampshire College raised the flag once again. Here's college president Jonathan Lash.
The reaction to lowering the flag had become something of a toxic circus. Rather than facilitating that discussion, which we've started over the past week, it became a distraction.
However, Brian Martin of the Massachusetts Veterans of Foreign Wars says it's about more than just a discussion.
This is what men and women have died for. They've fought for this symbol.
Well, joining us now in the studio to talk about this story and the rest of the week's news is John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. Hi there, John.
Hi, Meghna.
Also with us today is Zuri Berry. He's deputy managing editor for news and multimedia at the Boston Herald and co-host of Newsfeed on Boston Herald Radio. Zuri, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for
having me.
It's great to have you. So let's just dive right in here and just get your first initial thoughts from both of you on all that's been going on at Hampshire College, the decision to take the flag down, put it back up today, the protest that ensued. Zuri, you get first crack.
Well, I think there were a couple of mistakes made here on behalf of Hampshire College, the first being sort of the timing of the matter. And John, I would love to hear your take on this, but obviously having the idea to, one, as an expression of grief over violent deaths suffered in the country, take down and put the flag at half-mast or whatever may have you, to do that on November 9th, a date in which I believe immediately after the election, I think that was questionable in its own right. And then the second mistake being removing all flags after this incident of the flag burning, which I think is immaterial to the controversy here. I think those two mistakes were poor judgments on behalf of the administration and whoever was overseeing the flag in the first place.
Yeah, I think they framed this really badly. This could be a case study over at Harvard Business School of how not to handle public relations around a controversial issue. I think there are two stories about whether they removed all the flags or not. Mm-hmm. I think the one report said they did not remove all the flags from the campus. But this one was the central one. And I think that the aptly named Jonathan Lash really mishandled it in the beginning by labeling it, the flag, a disruptive symbol. I think that framed it in a way that was bound to draw protest and also set it up as a sort of confrontational issue. And he was asking for dialogue when he basically created an environment that didn't really foster dialogue. And he sort of reaped the results of that.
So let me just ask both of you. I mean, I have to say, we're in an interesting place where a college, an American college, looks at the United States flag, as you said, as a disruptive symbol. Because one of the questions I have now is, for students going there who felt troubled by seeing the flag, are they going to feel troubled I was asking this of my staff. Anytime they board an airplane, because the airplane always has a flag on it, are they going to feel troubled anytime they have to look a U.S. soldier in the eye? I mean, what about the positive disruptions that the flag has also been a symbol of? I mean, Union soldiers in the Civil War marched under a version of the Stars and Stripes.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but I kind of feel like this is just sort of feeds into the sort of mentality that these there are college students that need coddling, that cannot sort of handle any kind of speech or thought that is counter to their own personal beliefs or anything like that. And I think that's possibly wrongheaded in this particular situation, because what you're finding is that there was a reaction to a flag burning. Again, I think. Overall, immaterial to the situation at hand, but you have a mistake that occurs in putting this flag at half mast on November 9th, and there is this sort of aloofness as far as believing that this is not going to be connected with the results of the election. Whether it was Donald Trump being victorious on November 8th or Hillary Clinton, I think that there would have been a problem and a reaction to that, and that is part of the problem here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a big fan of the associate provost of coddling on campus, and I think that there were some tough lessons to be learned here, and I think that one of the problems was that nobody really framed it the way it should have been framed. When Jonathan Lash takes the flag down and says this is not a political act, that's dismissible out of hand, and I think the whole thing was political, and to deal with it that way was to deal with it in a forthright manner, and I think that they did not, and they tried to finesse it, and whenever you try to do that, very often when you try to do that, it blows
it
up in your face.
Yeah.
I think there was some worthy skepticism that was necessary when he said that it was about, you know, all violent deaths across the world. I mean, I don't believe that went over well with people that thought that was actually the case, that's what he actually believed.
Yeah, no, that went over like the metric system. Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the protest that ensued. Over the weekend at Hampshire College about the removal of the flag. We've got some sound here, and in it you'll hear basically there were a group of veterans who were gathering at their protest site for a group photo. A counter-protester actually disrupted the photo. According to Mass Live, this counter-protester made some obscene gestures and then sat in silence, and then this happened.
His rights are first. Our rights are last. His rights are first. Ours are don't count.
I will not let anybody touch him. Okay?
But we're better than the other side.
But no one will touch him. This is why we fought, right?
So it's a little difficult to understand who's saying what, but early in that clip you heard a man chanting, his rights are first, our rights are last. That was an older veteran chanting that. And then later on in the clip you hear another veteran say no one will touch him, that he wouldn't allow any of the protesters to touch or disrupt the counter-protester. And he said, no one will touch him. This is why we fought, right? So, I mean, to me, right then and there, and that, there's a little microcosm of perhaps some good, I have to say, that's come out of this controversy, because we're seeing American citizens engaging in all of the rights that are also captured within the symbol of the American flag. The right to protest, the right to be upset about the protest, the right to defend protesters. Right to protest.
Right, and the right to burn the flag.
Exactly.
Which
exactly.
I'm not urging anybody to do, but that's one of the rights, too. And so it was all rolled up in a bundle, and it was there for what they call the teachable moment, nobody got taught very much because they were operating across purposes, and they were basically talking past each other, and that never brings any kind of enlightenment.
Well, I don't want to just poo-poo the idea that the symbolism of any flag, because flags are very, very potent symbols. I mean, you know, look at all that's happened around the Confederate flag and the stars and bars. But because of that, I mean, that's another reason why when on Tuesday, President-elect Donald Trump tweeted, quote, nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be some consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail. I mean, that caught everyone's attention right then and there.
Yeah, and obviously in a reaction to all of this. And I would say that we're going to continue to have an argument about how we protest, because there is, and you've seen this with Black Lives Matter, you've seen this with Colin Kaepernick, as we talked about, and I'm sure you've addressed numerous times on this show, that people are always sort of criticizing these folks in the sense of, well, they shouldn't do it that way. They shouldn't protest in this manner, or they shouldn't protest against the flag, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no sort of consensus of what is the proper way to protest. And I think what we're what folks are coming around to and sort of getting back to is that any sort of form of protest, even the most egregious and ugly version, which you could consider the flag burning being a part of that, is allowed and okayed under our rules in Constitution. And whether or not that is something that we all find agreeable, whether or not we want to criticize the act in its own right, I mean, that comes down later.
Right. You know, I want to move on to another story here in just a second, but we should acknowledge that Hampshire College President Jonathan Lash also told WBUR just this morning that in response to their decisions around the flag, that they were getting a lot of graphic threatening calls and emails. So kind of an also ugly side to this story. And he told WBUR he felt that it was just safer to put the flag back up. So again, we can question whether that decision was later than it should have been, but want to acknowledge that there was that aspect of the story too. Okay, well, let's just move on here, if we can, and talk about legalized marijuana in Massachusetts. Of course, voted into law vis-a-vis question 4 on November 8th. And I have to say, this has elicited what might be my favorite newspaper quote of the week, possibly even the last 4 weeks. It comes from our friend, Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin, who told the Globe on Monday, quote, "All those tokers can hold their breath a little longer, but they'll be able to exhale by early 2017. Basically talking about how there may be some delays in enacting legalized marijuana. So first of all, John, let's start with you. Do you see a problem with the state delaying implementation?
I think they should delay it as long as they possibly can because they have no idea what they're doing. And really, I mean—
That's not an excuse.
It may not be an excuse, but it's a perfectly good strategy, I think. I think that they were handed a Rube Goldberg contraption of a ballot initiative that they have to sort out. I think that what's in the ballot initiative is going to be almost impossible to implement the way it's been presented.
Okay, so just let me jump in here because speaking of your Rube Goldberg contraption, we talked with State Treasurer Deb Goldberg, who has to implement a lot, no relation. But she said, you know, there's all these obstacles that are, in her mind, standing in the way of smooth implementation of recreational marijuana. I mean, for example, funding the commission that's going to oversee legal marijuana sales. So here's what she told us.
As of this moment, if I were to hire an executive director and appoint the three commissioners, I have no way to pay them. You know, revenues don't start coming in till you issue the licenses.
But you need the commission first.
Right.
So where's the money going to come from?
That's a very good question.
Crickets followed after that.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, this is something that frustrates me completely, and I'm totally opposite of John here in this regard. I think they should just go ahead and implement it as is, and continue to fix things as they go along, which is what they would normally do. Massachusetts has a rich history of failing to implement ballot initiatives. I think we all know how they messed up the medical marijuana portion. We're just now getting close to getting 5% tax rate in this state. And there are many other examples. And this sounds like it's going to go down that path of in which our elected officials, DeLeo Rosenberg and our treasurer, Deborah Goldberg, are all very much doing something that I would say is probably against the will of voters here. And that is usually being their inaction in one regard or another.
Well, not to get technical about it, but I don't think any voters actually read the ballot question.
I did.
Well, you did, but that's your job.
Yeah.
So a lot of people went in and they voted for the idea of legalization of recreational marijuana. I agree with you entirely that the legislature has been intransigent in too many instances where ballot initiatives have been passed. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
But if you look at the implementation of the medical marijuana law, you see something that is so halting and so tentative in its implementation that I think they should take their time, not violate the spirit of the ballot initiative.
But taking their time, aren't they by definition violating the spirit and the letter of the initiative? I mean, a lot of this is supposed to get underway in 2 weeks.
Well, we can turn into California, where they just keep passing propositions that contradict each other and result in absurd law. an absurd implementation. But I think a little caution here is going to go a long way.
There are outs here in this legislation, if you read through them, that allow for municipalities to go to their voters or through their city councils and communities and make changes that they see fit that need to occur. And I think what we're going to see is that as the legislator, obviously they have to pay for the commissioners to implement this, but as the legislator figures out the fixes and the add-ons that they need to do, they need to understand that they should not just go against the will of the voters by delaying this any further, because it is very simple to say that Massachusetts voters wanted recreational marijuana, they wanted medical marijuana before, and because of the way that they handled things with medical marijuana, that's what led to this point in time now. I don't think that it would help Rosenberg, DeLeo, and the rest of the state representatives to somehow continue to push against this, whether it's Walsh or anybody else. I think every single elected official was against marijuana. I don't think it would help any of them in regards to their voters and the people that sort of want this to continue to delay and use these sort of tactics.
But let me just jump in here, because I take your point. But on the other hand, say the delay is, a couple of months or maybe even 6 months. I don't know, because, you know, there's different phases of
I have no patience for it. I'm just going to say it.
I get that. But what if that delay allows Deb Goldberg, DeLeo, Stan Rosenberg, Everybody, the chance to really get it right for Massachusetts, so we don't have a medical marijuana repeat. And then once sales get off the ground, if you ask Deb Goldberg, she would say having that IT backbone so that sales can go through, getting the excise tax at a rate that maybe is more.
So the issue
positive.
That I have is that I believe that there are many industries within Massachusetts and other regulated, whether it's alcohol or otherwise, that you can sort of translate the regulations that are there and implement it there and sort of copy and paste, so to speak, so that way these things can be looked after and also implemented in a timely manner. I don't believe it takes, especially with this going into effect in January 2018, I don't believe it will take more than that, particularly to get shops up and running.
Let me add one note. We talk about the three commissioners on the Cannabis Control Commission, but they have to hire a whole army of other people to staff it. They need lawyers, they need accountants, they need tech people, the IT people, they need enforcement agents. I mean, the estimate is that this could cost $30 million to set this infrastructure up. Mm-hmm. So there's that. We're not talking about small dollars here, and we're not talking about a small bureaucracy either. We're talking about a pretty big bureaucracy. So I understand the impatience that people would have because of the delay, and maybe it's because of my advanced years. It seems to me that it would probably be worth it, but then again, essentially, I'm not one of the stakeholders here.
It does seem, though,
and I would also say that I'm not a stakeholder.
I'm not accusing you of anything, sorry.
I'm not, this is not an industry I would take part in personally or anything like that, and I know no one who would, actually. But my point being is that I think if the will of the voters say that this is something that they want and they've given this timeline through the legislation, I would assume that voters knew better.
Okay.
Sometimes that's a pretty big assumption.
Yeah, I mean, have you met voters?
Yeah. Let's not get all elitist now on the voters, please.
Just saying.
Oh, my God. Oh, I think we might have actually deserved that, Zuri. Okay, so we're not really shifting gears that much, but let's talk a little bit more about politics and start with what happened just yesterday at Harvard's Institute of Politics, because they hosted their regular post-presidential election conference, and it's when they invite very top senior level members of both campaigns to Harvard to talk, give a sort of an inside view of what happened. This year, there was a lot of heated moments, such as this exchange between Donald Trump's campaign manager Kellyanne Conway and senior Clinton pollster Joel Benenson. Excuse me. He tried to make the point that though Donald Trump is president-elect, Hillary Clinton did win more of the popular vote.
Listen, you guys won. That's clear. You won the Electoral College. That's the currency.
Let's
be honest. Don't act as if you have some popular mandate for your message. And Tony, we'll talk about the wrong track number again like you and I just did. The fact of the matter is that more Americans voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump.
And here's how Kellyanne Conway responded.
Why is
or no mandate? You've lost 60 congressional seats since President Obama got there. You got lost more than a dozen senators, a dozen governors, 1,000 state legislators.
We're talking about this election,
Kellyanne. No, no, you said there's no mandate.
So I'm just wondering briefly what you guys think about the fact that this particular fight, I mean, let alone across the nation, it still seems very much alive between senior levels of both campaigns.
Yeah, I understand they brought in food tasters during the lunch break. it's a microcosm of the campaign itself. And I think that all the hot buttons and all the dog whistles and everything that happened during the campaign and every failing on the part of the Clinton team and every questionable tactic on the part of the Trump team is still in the air, and it's still being debated actively by the public and obviously by these campaign aides.
I think it's clear that Democrats, particularly those that are on the front lines, like those that were at the Harvard Institute of Politics yesterday night, are very much viewing themselves as a resistance to this administration and the, I would say, Republican-led government at this point. And so I think when they start framing things as if there is a no mandate allowed for the Trump administration to go forth with its agenda, I think that's very much speaks from a point of resistance and also a point in which, you know, that's the last shot we have to fire here in order to sort of rally people on our side to say that, you know, we can't just, you know, walk or at least let these folks walk all over us for the next 4 years.
Mm. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape here because there's also the question of what's next for the Democratic Party as a whole. It's so funny because wasn't it like 6 months ago everyone was asking about what's the future of the GOP? Well, now it's what's the future of the Democratic Party? I mean, we're
still probably questioning both of those things.
Yeah, that's right. Next week we'll be talking about the GOP again. But we spoke with Congressman Stephen Lynch, and you know, earlier this week he was supporting Tim Ryan of Ohio for House Minority Leader. Nancy Pelosi ended up hanging on to that spot. But here's one of the things that Lynch pointed to us. He said that there's an underlying concern of many Democrats that there's a divide between party leadership and average Americans.
What Tim Ryan's candidacy is based on is that, you know, it's the difference between San Francisco and Youngstown, Ohio. And we're arguing that, you know, the economic struggles of average Americans is a unifying theme.
So, John, I mean, the difference between San Francisco and Youngstown or Boston and Youngstown?
There's two sort of dichotomies here that they were playing out in this process. One was the geographic one. The other was going for the money as opposed to going for the votes. And those charges were leveled at Pelosi and her management of the Democratic Party, her leadership of the Democratic Party. And the whole idea that they just turned their back on working people across the country and were spending their time, as one person said, at fundraisers as opposed to fish fries was something that really solidified it and galvanized this fight. And I think that's going to be the fight going forward. I think Nancy Pelosi is going to have a sort of a rocky road to go because there is a significant pushback from Democrats in the rank and file.
Zuri?
And this sort of continues the conversation about the messaging that comes out of Democrats right now, which is it going to be an economic one or is it going to be about identity politics? And is it going to be, again, catering to different minority groups in order to pull those coalitions together, which was thought to be the Obama coalition, in order to beat Republicans? And what we've seen, obviously, is that did not work overall, particularly with this candidate, Hillary Clinton. So it looks like the Youngstown, if I would say, argument of who this is, continue to go after the economic message and how we can help those people there. I think the negative attribution to San Francisco, I'm a San Francisco guy, is that all of a sudden we're only more concerned with the identity politics of everything, which is, I would say, the perception. I'll take it, but nonetheless, you understand where that messaging comes from.
Yeah. Well, this is definitely a discussion worth more exploration, and we'll keep having it in the coming weeks on the program. But I don't want to run out of too much time to have our hubbubs, because really, I mean, It's always good to end Friday on a lighter note, isn't it? So, John, your hubbub?
My hubbub is a new scientific study that that just came out about the great Boston molasses flood of 1919. And they were trying to determine why it was so deadly. It was very deadly. There were 2 million gallons that flowed through the North End. 21 people were killed, 150 injured. And the American Physical Society did some testing, and they came to realize that partly it was the temperature that that made it so deadly, because when it came out of the tank, it was going about 35 miles an hour. It had been heated for transport. When it hit the cold air, this is January, it hit the cold air, it started to solidify. And yeah, that's how people got trapped, and that's how people got drowned. So I think, kids, if you're listening at home, science is a wonderful thing, and you should pay more attention to it.
We're actually going to talk to some of those researchers next week, too, on the show. So thanks for the promo.
Excellent. Sure.
Zuri, your hubbub?
And my hubbub is about the Boston NAACP chapter. They just named a new president, Tanisha Sullivan. She had been running unopposed. She formerly worked as the chief officer in the Boston Public Schools Office of Equity, and she had been the one that signaled to administrators in early 2015 about the student bias complaints at Boston Latin School. So that hasn't been covered enough. She's also going to be joined by Lori Nelson. She's an official at the Boston Housing Authority. She's going to be a first vice president. She beat out Diane Wilkerson, the former state senator who was jailed on bribery charges. Diane Wilkerson lost by 11 votes. So very interesting. Obviously, Michael Curry, the outgoing prez, very much a active presence here in the Boston area.
Yeah.
And it will be interesting to see how Tanisha Sullivan continues that.
Absolutely. It's good hubbub. All right. So, you know, my hubbubs tend to range either about tech or animals. So like science or animals. Today, it's more in the science realm. But I have to give a giant hat tip to Beth Tytel, because my hubbub is really just a quote from her story today, at the bottom of the front page of the Globe, because she talked to a CEO of Cambridge-based Newtonomy. They're a self-driving car company. They're designing self-driving cars. And the CEO told her that, hey, you know, it's important for automated cars to be able to drive in human-like fashion. And that does mean adapting to the driving patterns around you, which, of course, in Greater Boston presents its own challenges. I always wondered if the driving was just too aggressive and random, and possibly would require too many computations from a car and they couldn't function. But Beth takes it a step further and says, so this is a quote from her story. So does that mean our automated cars, will they be designed to tailgate or to make left turns from the right lane? And come winter, will they slash the tires of the car that has parked in a space they've shoveled? So the future of self-driving vehicles in Boston might be a little more aggressive than
that's
you think.
That's a complicated algorithm, isn't it?
It is.
Will they know when I'm yelling at them?
Probably. Zuri Berry, Deputy Managing Editor for News and Multimedia at the Boston Herald and co-host of Newsfeed on Boston Herald Radio. Great to have you. Thank you so much. And John Carroll, Professor of Communications at Boston University and WBUR Senior News Analyst. Thank you as well.
Thanks.
Have a great weekend, gentlemen.
You too.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, we've been digging into the impact President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks might have on Massachusetts. And today, we'll look at education. Last week, Trump announced his pick for Secretary of Education, Michigan billionaire and Republican activist Betsy DeVos. DeVos is former chairwoman of the Michigan Republican Party and a passionate school choice proponent. She pushed a failed 2000 ballot initiative in Michigan to create a school voucher system. DeVos also founded, funded, and chairs the American Federation for Children, a policy advocacy group that promotes charter schools, vouchers, and other school choice initiatives. Trump, in the statement announcing her as his pick, said she will be able to, quote, break the bureaucracy that is holding our children back. So what might the pick mean for Massachusetts? Well, joining us now in the studio is Paul Revel. He's professor of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and he also served as the Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts under Governor Deval Patrick. Professor Revel, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, I mean, how important is the specific person who is the federal secretary for the states? I mean, what's the relationship like between someone who is at the level you are at and the federal Department of Education?
Well, first of all, if you're a Secretary of Education, you need to carry out the policies that are articulated by your principal. If it's the governor, it's the governor's policies. And if it's the president, it's the president's policies. In this case, candidate Trump, at any rate, seemed to place a fairly low priority on education. In particular, he talked some about early childhood and the need for more daycare. He talked some about the student debt crisis at higher education level. And he talked occasionally about the need for more choice in the K-12 system and occasionally expressed his displeasure with the Common Core. But you have to say that education for neither candidate really was not a top priority, not something they talked a great deal about. And I think that's one of the things to note in the beginning here, irrespective of who's secretary. In the near term, I don't expect this to be a policy priority for aggressive moves forward by the administration. Right.
But he has picked as his Secretary of Education someone who has been very, very active advancing a school choice agenda. I mean, that has been at the heart of Betsy DeVos's advocacy in Michigan for quite some time.
Well, both in Michigan and nationally.
And
she's been a very forceful proponent, made stronger by the fact that she can back it up with lots of donations to causes. She's founded organizations, participated in others. And I think what's important to note about her is she has a very broad conception of school choice. We've recently had a heated battle over choice in Massachusetts, but it's been confined to a discussion of well-regulated charter schools and whether or not we ought to lift the cap. Secretary-designee DeVos's idea of choice is much broader than that. It amounts to vouchers, giving money to students to take that money to private schools, to parochial schools, to for-profit schools. She's interested in opportunity scholarship. She's interested in tax credits. She's interested in sort of a wholesale array of avenues to allow people to exit the mainstream system and to go to outside sources of schooling.
I mean, we have seen in federal ed secretaries in the past a certain proactiveness that may have rubbed folks the wrong way. I'm thinking about Arne Duncan.
I mean,
he was possibly the most powerful and influential education secretary at the federal level we've seen in some time. Would it be possible for Betsy DeVos to be as influential as Duncan was?
I think it's unlikely because, Meghna, Congress voted well before Donald Trump was elected president. Congress voted in the reauthorization of what we call the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which had been called No Child Left Behind, a new act called the Every Student Succeeds Act. And that, more than anything, was a clear message by a Republican Congress to the executive branch that we don't want a muscular activist Department of Education. We want to push these choices down to the state and local level where constitutionally they belong. And after all, Donald Trump ran on a states' rights, local prerogative kind of campaign. So I would think even on a subject like school choice, about which there is a fair amount of interest among Republicans in particular and some Democrats, it's going to be very hard for the federal government to take a strongly proactive. I mean, people don't want to be told by the federal government what they should be doing in education, and that includes the subject of school choice. So I think there'll be pushback on this. However, with the president-elect strong commitment and her track record in terms of working very hard on these issues, I think you can expect some policy to come forward in this vein.
So let's talk about some of the potential specifics, because Betsy DeVos herself in the past has talked very positively about vouchers, for example, and that, you know, would it be possible for, what is it, some 10 or... I hope I get this number at $10 or $15 billion in terms of Title I funding.
$20 billion
Title I funding from the federal government. I mean, could that end up being passed down to the state through a voucher system?
Well, I think it's unlikely to directly come through a voucher system. What I think is we're more likely see is some kind of incentive that's put forward by the federal government to encourage states, much as Race to the Top, ironically, did, to expand school choice within states, but not to be prescriptive in terms of how you do it. I think that the Republicans themselves will disagree about whether or not they're in favor of vouchers. Vouchers have been almost uniformly rejected by voters across the country whenever it's been put to voters, most recently in Michigan in her home state. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to be said that Betsy DeVos in the state of Michigan has a troubled track record in terms of school choice. Number one, she's not been able to get through the array of choices, vouchers and tax credits and scholarships that she wanted to see. Michigan only has charter schools, and they have arguably one of the worst charter school programs in the country. 75% of the schools are for-profit schools. The overwhelming majority are performing well below average, and Detroit is an out-and-out disaster. So what's happened in terms of school choice and charter schools in Michigan has been a real problem for the charter school movement as a whole. However, that being said, I think elsewhere in Massachusetts, I think we've done charter schools well.
Yeah, and very differently, obviously,
and very differently, a very well-regulated, targeted approach to authorizing charter schools. So I think you will see interest in Congress in doing something, but I think Republicans themselves will disagree about the details. The devil's in the details. So it's going to be hard to get consensus on a highly prescriptive federal program.
Yeah. You know, so I was also wondering about what actual state laws that we have here in Massachusetts and how that might affect, you know, the reality of any kind of even semi-voucher program, if I can call that, because we were looking back in history and we found that some 38 states actually have anti-aid amendments that would make vouchers next to impossible. And in Massachusetts, we have one that dates back to 1855, the Know-Nothing Amendment that actually prevents disbursements of state funds and local tax revenues to parochial schools. That was expanded in 1917 to private schools as well. So does that just by definition block any sort of federal voucher system from coming to Massachusetts?
Well, I think it's indicative of the kind of tangles that a federal prescription or a federal mandate would run into, which is why I would expect to see a more incentive money come down to try and stimulate states to change their own laws. So we have those prohibitions in state law in Massachusetts. A state could presumably change that if they wanted to do so and if they were sufficiently incentivized to do so. I might point out that in Massachusetts, when I was in office under Governor Patrick's leadership, we passed through the legislature the most substantial cap lift in some time. So that was a response in part, at least, to the race to the top incentive money that was on the table. So the federal government put down an incentive. The state responded, changed the law to allow for a cap lift. I'd expect to see something like that happen, even though, ironically, candidate Trump was highly critical of race to the top and that kind of federal involvement.
So it seems as what you're saying is, in part because of the bill, the bipartisan bill passed and signed last year by President Obama, and Congress's reluctance to expand federal involvement in education in the states, that this may be one area in which the federal secretary actually could have a limited impact, and in fact states could lead instead of follow a federal government mandate.
I think what you'll see is some kinds of federal openings and leaving it up to states to take the prerogative. I think Betsy DeVos is well known politically. She has influence. She's a billionaire. She's donated a lot to Republican causes and other causes across the country. So, I mean, I think she'll be politically astute and she'll be helpful to the president in that regard. But at the same time, I think she's going to run into a lot of opposition about how you do school choice and about the degree to which the federal government can really push states to do things. I'm hoping that, for example, in some other areas, like in the area of early childhood, where they have said they want to do more in the way of daycare, that they'll think not just about daycare, which is in effect babysitting, but think about early childhood education. Some real openings and opportunities there. Or to think in the higher education end of things, candidate Trump often said that one of the things that most moved him on the campaign trail was the reaction against the student debt crisis in higher education. So he wants to do something there. I think if she tries to tackle, for example, Title I funding, There's going to be a lot of resistance to that. Taking $20 billion, which now goes to the neediest schools, the schools serving the neediest kids in the United States, is going to be resisted even in Republican communities.
Mm. I mean, so you pointed out two other sectors that are very, very important to Massachusetts, early childhood ed and higher ed, obviously critical parts of the state's economy and quality of life as a whole. But on the higher ed side, I'm not sure I know exactly what Betsy DeVos even thinks about a higher ed or what the issues are.
I don't think she's had a lot of experience there. She certainly hasn't articulated her views on that topic. Candidate Trump did put forward a proposal which was criticized as being too expensive, even though he criticized Hillary Clinton's plan for being too expensive. He did put forward a debt relief kind of program. So, you know, I think you'll see some new thinking there. He, after all, for better or worse, was a college president, a college leader at any rate, a sponsor and a founder of a college. It was a for-profit. It had it's gotten into some disastrous tangles in terms of for-profits. The Obama administration and Arne Duncan were very tough on regulating for-profit schools. I'd expect that to be relieved. Betsy DeVos is apparently an anti-regulatory kind of person, which is why you have this Wild West atmosphere for charter schools now in Michigan.
Well, last question for you while I have you. We've been asking this of everyone who's come in to talk to us about what Trump's cabinet picks might mean for Massachusetts. I mean, if you were the state's Secretary of Education today, I mean, what would you be thinking? What would be your primary area of focus or question when looking at the state's relationship with the federal government?
Well, I mean, I think right now, were I in that position, I'd keep my head down and take advantage of the opportunity to move forward and do the work that we think needs to be done. We've got a long history of that in Massachusetts. We haven't been waiting, you know, over the past 25 years for a federal message as to what we ought to do. We've been a leader, and Massachusetts has always been a leader in public education. So I think particularly after this ballot question, we need to move forward on an agenda with respect to how are we going to close achievement gaps in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? How are we going to do better in preparing our children in early childhood to come to school? How are we going to help them do better in learning to read by grade 3? How are we going to have better career pathways for them? How are we going to get a higher rate of admission and preparation for college and better college completion? We've got a lot of challenges ahead. And the idea that it's all about school choice or it's all about charter schools or we should wait around for a lead from the federal government, I think is mistaken. I'd rather see us sort of dig in, form a new reform agenda for Massachusetts and move aggressively forward. And I think we'll have the running room because, as I say, I think the federal government's going to be preoccupied for a while.
Well, Paul Revel is a professor of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He served as the Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts under Governor Deval Patrick. Professor Revel, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna. Pleasure to be here.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, right here in front of me, I have one of the happiest books to cross my desk in some time. It's called Dory's Cookies, and it's by acclaimed cookbook author Dory Greenspan. More than 500 pages of cookie lore and recipes for every kind of cookie imaginable. And Dory Greenspan joins us in the studio to talk about these cookies and to taste some of them with us. I have to say, she has written more than 12 cookbooks, including the New York Times bestsellers Around My French Table and Baking Chez Moi. She wrote Baking with Julia after spending a summer in Julia Child's kitchen. And she writes the Everyday Dory column for the Washington Post. But she's here with us in the studio now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here. And you sat me near the ginger molasses cookies. The smell of them is just so wafting over.
We have a multi-talented staff. Not only can they produce radio, but they can make these great cookies, which they made straight out of your cookbook.
And they are so beautiful. It makes me so happy to see them.
Okay. So why don't you? Okay, so tell me a little bit more about the double ginger molasses cookie. What's the story there?
So this cookie, the recipe for it was sent to me by my friend Christine, and I made them, and they came out the way ginger snaps always do, kind of flat and crunchy, and they were delicious. They were so delicious that I felt like they disappeared too quickly. And so I redid the recipe to make them in muffin tins so that they would be thicker and chewier and so that the flavor would last longer.
Well, I'm going to reach across the table here.
Here, have one. Oop, you need long arms. Okay.
Banging into the microphone and everything. And oh, they are so very good. But try not to eat on the radio. It's not very attractive, but these taste so good.
Well, I want you to eat, even if it is radio. So it has fresh ginger. The cookie has fresh ginger and dried ginger and chocolate and a little espresso. It's got a really interesting mix of spices.
So what is it about cookies that seems so elemental, such a primal source of joy? Is it just that they're sweet confections, or is there something more?
No, I think there's really something more. I think some of it has to do with how personal a cookie is. All yours, and you can eat it any way you want. But I also think we grow up on cookies. You know, my mother did not bake, used her oven for a bread box. But my memories are of cookies. And I found a picture of me holding our son at his first birthday party. And he's holding a homemade cookie. Uh-huh. I think, and he says, cookies are memories. And I think they are, because they're, even if they're not homemade, they're something that, a pleasure that we have very, very often. And I think it's always associated with a nice time.
So what's your memory cookie?
My memory cookie, actually, we have the classic jammer here.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so this is a cookie that I dreamed. I was in Paris. I was working on the cookie book. And in the middle of the night, I saw a cookie. This doesn't always happen to me. But I saw it fully formed, beautiful. Kind of elbowed my husband and said, I dreamed a cookie. He rolled over. But I think he's used to it. But in the morning, I got up and baked this cookie, and it was just as I had dreamed it was. It is nothing like anything that I had as a child.
So the recipe was in your dream too? Or
everything.
Just...
everything. Okay. I just saw it. But the cookie is not really a cookie from childhood at all. I'll describe what it is in a second. But it's the butter and jam that reminds me of the Austrian-German cookies that my mother used to buy from a bakery near our house. So this cookie is, it's built also in a muffin tin. It's a vanilla shortbread cookie. It has jam in the center, and it has streusel around the edges. So you get the flakiness of the shortbread and the crunch of the streusel and that wonderful fruity flavor of jam.
Okay, I'm going to give it a try here because it also looks beautiful. It's a very attractive cookie.
It almost looks like a little tart.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was...
Oh. My dad is laughing at me on the other side of the glass. They're crying. These are good, guys. You did a good job.
Wait. And I'm smiling because you bit it and then put your hand to your
I
heart.
Did.
Actually, the classic jammers are one of my favorites in the book. A little arts and crafts project.
So the book has hundreds of recipes.
170 yeah.
recipes. It also has tips, baking tips for cookies, which I find really helpful because I, unlike my producers, I am not a champion baker. I've always kind of struggled when it comes to baking. Other kind of cooking I can do because I find doughs to be very temperamental and they don't react well to me. So do you have a good tip or two for cookie baking?
So I made a discovery a few years ago that changed my life. And it has to do with cookies that you roll out and cut, which I think are the cookies that give people the most problems mm-hmm. because the dough should be cold and then the cookies should be cut very crisply. So I made this discovery that if you make the dough and roll it out immediately, put it between two pieces of parchment paper or wax paper. It's so easy. The real instructions were make the dough, put it in the refrigerator, and then when it was hard, roll it. Well, you can't roll it when it's hard. It just is impossible. But if you roll it when it's soft, it's totally submissive. It'll do anything you want. And then you chill it. And it makes making cutout cookies such a pleasure. Uh-huh. It's also helpful. Same technique for pie dough and tart dough.
Oh, okay.
Life changer.
Totally. I mean, my husband loves to make mince pies for mm-hmm. Christmas. And we have an almond shortbread recipe that we use for the tart part
right.
of the mince pie. And I have that problem every time because
we've
got to chill it.
Then,
I got to beat it. And then I'm heating it up as I'm rolling it out. And it's getting
and you're
upset
yelling at
it.
Yeah.
It's
And
it falls
you're getting
apart.
Upset. Yep, yep. Changed. This will be a better year, I promise.
We will try that. Okay, I want to ask you about another cookie here before we run out of time. The World Peace Cookie.
Oh, this cookie. So this cookie, it's a chocolate, kind of shortbread cookie, kind of chocolate chip cookie. So it has both brown sugar and white sugar and cocoa, chunks of dark chocolate, and fleur de sel, sea salt. And I got this cookie, the recipe for it, from Pierre Hermé, who's a very famous French pastry chef. And he called it the Corova cookie because he had made it for a restaurant in Paris called Corova. And then shortly after I had published the recipe in my book, Paris Sweets, a neighbor of mine said, oh, I love your chocolate cookies, but we don't call them whatever that name is. We call them World Peace Cookies because if everyone in the world had these cookies, peace would reign.
Absolutely.
And they are, I can never get enough of these. I could make these every day and be happy making them. They're slice and bake cookies, so they're real easy.
Yeah, and I mean, look, they've got chocolate, and chocolate, and they just
there's that
fill you with happiness. We have just a few seconds here. Do you think you can just in 10 seconds tell me about cookies and kindness?
It's my sweet revolution. I'm trying to make the world sweeter. People, I would love you to bake cookies and tag them with the hashtag cookies and kindness. You can tag me at Dory Greenspan so I can see what you're doing. And let's just spread joy.
We will take pictures of these and add them to your hashtag today.
Cookies and kindness. Thank you.
The new book is Dory's Cookies. They're by Dory Greenspan. She's written 12 cookbooks, including Around My French Table. She will be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight to talk about Dory's Cookies at 7 o'clock. We've got more information about that at RadioBoston.org. Dory Greenspan, thank you so much for bringing these cookies, for bringing a little world peace and happiness to our table today.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
And hope everyone out there has a great weekend. Bake some cookies. We'll see you on Monday. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.